We've asked listeners statewide, what questions do you have about the coronavirus? Today, we're getting some answers. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Dr. Fred Campbell of the Long School of Medicine at UT Health San Antonio takes on listener questions about COVID-19 plus. Attention shoppers, a certain statewide grocer on the front lines of this crisis asking for help from the public. How high tech is trying to tackle COVID-19, and amid warnings about future lack of bed space, are Texas hospitals ready? Those stories and a whole lot more when the Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 26th day of March, 2020. Shortly after we went off the air yesterday, President Trump declared a major disaster in Texas 2 days after Governor Abbott's request for the same. Dallas Morning News reporting that the money will be used to help state and local officials taking COVID-19 protective measures in the Lone Star State. More on that in a moment. I'm David Brown in the Texas Capital City. Like so many other cities in Texas, a virtual ghost town downtown, albeit a rather warm one. One image making the rounds online is a photograph taken near the city's iconic Barton Springs swimming pool, showing dozens of swimmers apparently oblivious to or not particularly interested in the city's stay-at-home orders. Clearly not everyone's swimming. Someone's still got to answer calls at the Texas Workforce Commission, which normally gets 13,000 calls a day. The Houston Chronicle reports that on Sunday alone, the Workforce Commission received 100,000 calls and more than 800,000 people were trying to get through by phone. More than 150,000 unemployment insurance claims were filed in Texas last week, and the total is now closing in on 30,000 new claims per day at last check. New numbers nationwide, very grim. 3 million Americans seeking benefits. The new unemployment number breaking records with almost 700,000 people making new claims nationwide, and that's expected to rise. Of course, there's a lot of anxiety across Texas as workers are getting furloughed. Hospitality industry, among others, remains on de facto lockdown. Many workers and their families wondering how they'll pay the rent or their mortgages in just a few days. But the Senate, the U.S. Senate, has passed a plan that could provide, at least for a short while, some form of relief. Joining us now is Dr. Brandon Rodinghouse. He's a political science professor at the University of Houston, and he's been following this story. Brandon, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, David.
Let's talk about some of the highlights in this economic stimulus package passed by the U.S. Senate late last night. This is easily the biggest financial relief package that's ever been taken on by in U.S. history. But what kind of relief can Americans, and for that matter, Texans, expect to see as a result of this measure?
You're right. It is a massive bill. It's more than double the $800 billion that were appropriated in 2009 after the 2008-2009 recession sent the country into a serious economic tailspin. A couple of things this does. We call this a Christmas tree bill. It's a big bill with lots of shiny stuff on it. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing for individuals is that there's going to be checks cut to adults, about $1,200 per adult and $500 per child. You have to qualify. So if you make above $75,000, you won't qualify. But for those who are under that number, they're likely to get a check in the mail. There's also going to be expanded unemployment benefits to people who are likely to lose their jobs. And like you said a moment ago, there's a lot of that happening.
There are some stories. The New York Times has a terrific frequently asked questions or fact on this thing. Gig workers are notably covered for unemployment this go around. So it seems like it's taking on or it's adapting to changing times, at least in part.
Yeah, I think that's definitely an update to the way that we treat workers that's so important to so many people, and it's part of most people's livelihoods, if not all. Some, you know, who are doing that do it full-time, some do it part-time, but it's a major component. And this bill has to be able to adjust to how people live. So among the other things that are occurring on this are about $350 billion for small business loans. There's $500 billion in loans for distressed companies. There are also millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars for adjustments to state elections. So Texas is likely to see a big chunk of money to possibly change the parameters for how we vote.
This still needs to clear the U.S. House of Representatives, and then the president needs to sign this. Do you expect any snags along the way?
There are always snags. You know, people complain about how slow Washington works, but to be honest, this is pretty much Washington working at warp speed. They don't move very quickly. The procedural rules are going to allow them to probably be able to take a vote in a day or two. The issue is that it might be that they call for a specific roll call vote, which in that case would delay the process by a day. The politics of this are complicated. You've got the Republicans who are saying that effectively Democrats are pushing partisan proposals into the package, doing things like adding emission standards or adding funding for the Kennedy Center. Democrats say it's basically just a big cash giveaway for corporations without much oversight. What's interesting is that in the 2008-2009 recession, that stimulus bill gave rise to some of the elements of the Tea Party, that kind of reactionary Republican element that displeased, so much of that spending. The interim years have kind of slowed their impact if they haven't had as much traction in governing. But I think this $2 trillion bill is likely to throw gasoline on the embers of that movement.
Just a few seconds left, but I mentioned President Trump approved Governor Abbott's request for a major disaster declaration for Texas. Is it clear how funds from that declaration differ from the bill in Congress?
Yeah, it allows the Texas to be able to tap money for specific crisis counseling, legal services, nutrition assistance. It also lets the governor suspend rules that otherwise might get in the way of trying to fix the issues involving the disaster. So it gives the governor expanded powers, which he needs to be flexible in this time of crisis.
Dr. Brandon Rodinghouse, political science professor, University of Houston, has been following this story closely. Dr. Rodinghouse, good to talk with you again, sir. Thank you.
You too, David. Thanks.
In times like these, it's our responsibility to give you the absolute best advice that we can. And given both the questions that we're getting from listeners and the deficit of MDs on the Texas Standard staff, we thought it might be best to bring in an expert. So as long as the coronavirus pandemic continues, we're going to be joined regularly by Dr. Fred Campbell. He is a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine at UT Health San Antonio. And he's said that he is willing to take on your questions. Dr. Campbell, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
Before we get started answering some of the listener questions we've gathered, can you tell us a little bit more about your medical experience? When did you get started in medicine?
I actually graduated from Baylor College of Medicine in 76 and did a residency in Los Angeles at UCLA. I have been in active practice since 1976 and have recently been practicing at UT Health faculty practice here in San Antonio.
We appreciate your willingness to take on some of these questions. And as I was just saying, each week we're going to try to tick through a few of the questions that we've received. If you've submitted one and you don't hear it, don't worry. We'll get to them eventually. But I want to get to the first few. One that we received quite a few times, in fact, here, Doctor. Once someone has contracted the coronavirus and then recovered, can they get reinfected?
We, of course, have very few experiences with that particular situation, although there are individuals now in places like China and in Europe that have, in fact, been released after having a successful treatment in the hospital. There are other people that apparently are having the infection at home and not requiring hospitalization. Mm-hmm. So we will gather more information soon with most coronaviruses and other similar cold viruses, even influenza, it's unusual to have a relapse once one is completely over the acute illness. Mm-hmm. But that is possible, particularly in a very high-risk individual who may have a very low immune response due to a chronic illness.
So it's possible is what you're saying, but it's not going to be common unless you're suffering from some underlying issues related to, say, your immune system.
On the basis of our experience with other viruses of a similar nature, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Now, here's another. Texas is a high allergy environment. What are some clear ways to distinguish symptoms between allergies and the coronavirus?
That's an excellent question. It's clear that there are some individuals that have experienced a COVID-19 infection with minimal symptoms, something very similar to what one might encounter with an allergy, such as a stuffy nose, a mild cough, without red flag symptoms such as fever or shortness of breath. Mm-hmm. So it might be difficult to distinguish those, but we're only advising people with red flag symptoms at this point to actually seek medical attention, and those would be fever of 100 degrees or more, or shortness of breath of any type.
Doctor, another question from our listeners. What percentage of people who contract the coronavirus are asymptomatic?
Apparently, virtually everyone has an asymptomatic period that can go several days. And unfortunately, that may be the highest communicable period. People do have very mild infections. I don't know that there's anyone that doesn't react at least minimally to the virus with, say, a stuffy nose or a dry cough, however.
We've been talking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He is a doctor of internal medicine and an associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. He's agreed to join us regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to try to answer your questions. Now, if you have one, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or just shoot us an email at texasstandard@kut.org. Dr. Campbell, these are very helpful answers. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, let's bring in our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, at this juncture. Wells, what are you hearing from across Texas on this Thursday?
Hi, David. Well, the staggering number of unemployment claims over the past week, 3.3 million nationwide, 150,000 plus in Texas, have our online friends talking. On our Facebook page, Pat Snow says, I'm retired but very concerned for my immediate family. My son-in-law is in the oil and gas business. My daughter is a teacher. Most people we know live from paycheck to paycheck, and Americans have way too much debt, he adds. Blythe Johnson says, I work in an optometrist's office and we were shut down last week. I will have a job once we can resume routine eye exams, but until then, me and many, many others are out of work and health insurance. And Nicole LeBlanc says, I'm just holding my breath until we see the provisions in the Senate's relief bill for the self-employed, like many millions of other self-employed people with businesses run on a shoestring and where SBA loans play no part. I am very worried. Very concerning numbers, those unemployment numbers, as we were discussing earlier, David. I'll be back with more reactions later in the show.
If we haven't yet heard from you, Texas, you know what to do, right? Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is looking for you, and he's going to be back with more of the Talk of Texas in about 35 or so.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
This is Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. You may remember Governor Greg Abbott's recent executive order prohibiting elective surgeries, presumably to preserve resources for the COVID-19 fight. Well, now the fallout from that move has drawn a lawsuit from Planned Parenthood and others. Texas Public Radio's Joy Palacios reports on why.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton wrote an opinion on Monday saying the elective surgery ban applies to abortions. The emergency federal lawsuit on Wednesday is asking for them to continue. San Antonio-based Planned Parenthood South Texas is listed as a plaintiff. Its CEO, Jeffrey Hans, says abortions were put on pause.
Every day that passes by, there are more women who thought they were going to be able to determine their reproductive destiny being told that they are no longer in charge of their bodies. And that's why we are seeking this relief immediately.
Planned Parenthood argues there are abortion methods like pills that do not need the equipment and that abortion is essential health care. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Any Texan who's been in a grocery store these past few weeks has seen the pandemic's effect up close. We may joke about toilet paper hoarding and the like, but behind the scenes, one of the most amazing emergency mobilizations to behold has been at your grocery store. Today, Dia Campos, HEB's Director of Public and Government Affairs, is on the line with us to talk about what it takes to stock all those shelves by 8 a.m. and also how their own staff is holding up. Dia, welcome to Texas Standard.
Thank you.
First, how are you holding up? How are you doing?
You know, HEB is always ready to step in and serve our communities in times of need. And we're used to doing it in hurricanes and natural disasters. And this time of need is just going to be a little longer and take a little longer for our communities to recover. But we are ready for the challenge.
Is it true that you have like an emergency center, an actual sort of operations center, and you're sort of staffing it all around the clock?
HEB has a few different emergency operations centers. In a typical disaster situation, we're all together in one location. But due to the nature of this crisis, we have separated into several different emergency operations centers around the city of San Antonio in order to adhere to social distancing practices.
I think a lot of listeners would be really surprised to know that there's all this planning that goes into it. But I'm wondering how common it is to have this sort of monitoring and emergency setup in the retail grocery business, or is HEB sort of doing what most major grocery retailers have been doing?
You know, I cannot speak for other retailers. I know that at HEB, we are always looking to monitor any kind of threat or situation that could impact Texas, our customers, and our partners. And we approached the coronavirus no differently. And we continue every day to learn from retailers who are a few weeks ahead of us going through the same type of situation. And we are implementing very early tactics that they have shared with us that help stop the spread of the coronavirus. And we believe that the faster that Texas can halt the spread and slow the spread, the faster that we can get back to business as usual.
Of course, part of that is these stay-at-home orders that we're now seeing in all the major cities across Texas. How does that affect HEB? I mean, I know you have a delivery service, but those times are pretty much taken up by orders already, right?
Yeah, this under these circumstances, there is not a business in the world that wishes to operate under these circumstances. It is extremely difficult and straining on our supply chain, and quite frankly, for all businesses in Texas. However, based on research and learnings from around the world, the stay-at-home orders are really important. We have to stop the spread of the virus, and we need to get through the next couple of months. But what people need to know is that access to food is plentiful. Grocery stores remain open, and so do restaurants. All of our restaurants are open for takeout and delivery. They're here to serve Texas just as much as HEB is.
Now, that's interesting. But I want to get back to the business of these stay-at-home orders, because one of the exceptions is going to get groceries. What is HEB telling its customers? If you need something, come on and get it, or use curbside delivery. Again, a lot of those times are already occupied, right? So what are you telling your customers to do right now?
Right. So there are several options. We would prefer for customers to stay home. So HEB curbside and delivery is an option. We are opening up new time slots daily, building more capacity in order to do that. So we encourage customers to plan ahead for the next couple of months. We need to have a more long-term strategy and thinking around how we're going to defeat this virus. Another option, especially for seniors, is to use favor delivery. We have reserved slots on favor deliveries specifically for seniors.
This is Favor, the company you're talking about, like the app Favor, right?
That's right. The app Favor, or the website favordelivery.com, where we also have a 1-800 number that seniors can call into if they do not have access to a computer. And they can have access to build a list, a grocery list, and have a runner go to the grocery store, shop for them, pick it up and drop it at their doorstep. Another precaution we would like our customers to take is, you know, HEB is a family company. We love having families in our stores, and Texans are used to shopping as a family. Mm. One thing that is very helpful right now is for families to send one person to the store, and that is something we think will allow us to expedite the shopping experience and to also keep our customers and our partners safe.
So three things that shoppers can do. We're going to have a link to this conversation over at texasstandard.org. Before I let you go, Ms. Campos, what do you need? I mean, what could, say, government do better for you right now? Are those conversations happening?
Yes, they are. You know, local government and state government has been right by our side in lockstep. The first person to reach out to HEB and to keep in contact with us on a daily basis is Governor Abbott and his team of staff who are paying close attention to the supply chain and our needs. Local government, the same. We are in communication with our mayors and city managers across the state daily. We need our communities to understand that social distancing is the key to defeating this virus. And I also ask, you know, we are so grateful at HEB for the support of our partners working in stores and working in our warehouses. We've heard a lot of great comments and people referring to our partners as emergency responders. And essentially they are. We understand that they are in the front line. And we are here every day, every moment of the day to protect them, to give them the tools they need to keep healthy and protect themselves in order to serve our customers better.
A lot of long days for Dia Campos, HEB's Director of Public and Government Affairs down at the San Antonio Emergency Operations Center. Ms. Campos, in the middle of all this, we appreciate you taking a few minutes out of your schedule to talk with us on the Texas Standard. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Little music from our friends Austin's own Bright Light Social Hour, taking us up to 29 minutes past Texas Standard Time. We'll have a whole lot more ahead. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Workforce Commission is increasing its call center staff to manage a surge in requests for unemployment benefits from people who've lost their jobs due to the coronavirus pandemic. During a Facebook Live Q&A Wednesday, Executive Director Ed Cerna explained how many calls the state agency typically receives.
On a normal day, we will take about 13,000 phone calls in one of our four call centers. We have four call centers around the state. Normal day, about 14,000 calls. On the 22nd of March, we took 100,000 calls.
Cerna said Texas is nearing 30,000 unemployment claims per day. Last week, a record 3.3 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits. 150,000 of them were Texans. In the fight against the coronavirus, the White House is calling into service some of the world's most powerful supercomputers. And as KUT's Trey Shar reports, that includes one at the University of Texas.
UT Austin says its Frontera supercomputer already was being used by COVID-19 researchers. It's part of the new public-private partnership intended to speed up the fight against the virus. Dan Stanzione is executive director of UT's Texas Advanced Computing Center.
Doing molecular modeling and trying to figure out the actual structure of the virus, which helps with the drug screening process and finding things that will bind to that virus and stop it from spreading.
UT says its supercomputer already has helped researchers begin developing a 200 million atom computer model of the coronavirus that is expected to offer insight into how the virus infects people. I'm Trey Shar in Austin.
Cities and counties across the state continue to postpone court proceedings due to concerns over COVID-19. As Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports, the largest city in Texas has decided to suspend them for another month.
Jury trials are suspended until May in Houston. They were initially postponed through the rest of March. The city's municipal courts have also suspended jury duty arraignments and parking adjudication hearings through early May as well. The court is open for all other proceedings.
That's Sasha Cordner reporting. And Texas schools now have more flexibility when providing meals to students while they're closed. The Texas Department of Agriculture announced last night the state had secured additional federal waivers. One allows parents to pick up meals on behalf of their children, even when their children are not present. Under an executive order from Governor Greg Abbott, all Texas schools must remain closed until April 3rd. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As scientists work to develop vaccines and other medical responses to COVID-19, some technology companies are offering resources to that fight and to projects aimed at slowing the spread of the virus in other ways. Their contributions range from donated money and masks to partnerships with the World Health Organization. Tech expert Omar Gayaga joins us once again to tell us what companies are involved and how they're trying to help out. Omar, good to talk with you again.
Hey, David. Good to be here.
You staying healthy? Everything okay in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, everything's good so far. Just kind of scared and locked down like everybody else.
Yeah, like everybody else. We've heard about big tech companies trying to do something to offset the big lockdown, donating money to anti-coronavirus efforts and that sort of thing. Name some names. Who are some of these donors and where does their money appear to be going?
Yeah, it's a lot of the usual suspects, the ones you would expect that would kind of step up in a situation like this. You know, your Amazons and Googles and Facebooks, your Elon Musks, your Priscilla Chans, they are donating. But it hasn't just been monetary funds or taking care of their employees. It's also been things like forming coalitions to try to help scientists or being involved with initiatives by the White House to try to kind of collect data or provide other kinds of tech services. So it's been monetary, but also a lot of just the resources and sort of the tech firepower that these companies have.
I was trying to plot some of those names on a map, and it sounds like many of these individuals and companies are West Coast oriented. What about in other parts of the country? Or I would imagine there are considerable donations to COVID-19 relief, right?
Yeah, that's been sort of a criticism of the tech industry is that a lot of these efforts for donations and for resources have been very focused on Seattle, San Francisco, and LA. And obviously, you know, Seattle is one of the hotspots and definitely needs the help. But, you know, like I mentioned, Elon Musk, I mean, his efforts were based on, I think, the Los Angeles area. So there has been some criticism that the tech industry hasn't kind of reached further out into the country than kind of Silicon Valley.
One of the things that a lot of people have been critical of is how the role of social media, especially when it comes to spreading misinformation online of the political sort. What about during this pandemic? What are you hearing about the role of social media and the spread of information?
Yeah, I mean, that's been an issue. And I mean, we heard about Google building this website for information that was kind of slow to roll out. You know, if you go on Facebook, you see sort of this header above your posts, you know, promising to give you better information than what you might see, you know, spread around. But again, you know, we're running into the same issue we have during the election cycles, is that there's still a lot of bad information out there, a lot of people spreading bad information, and it's just not very easy to tell the good from the bad info. So I think social media companies are still struggling. I mean, they're trying, but they're really not keeping up with the amount of bad information out there coming from all different places.
I gather that some companies, and we're talking about maybe not companies, but some public entities, including NASA, are using their access to very large computers to help with research into the virus. What's going on there?
Yeah, NASA and the National Science Foundation are creating a kind of a computer resource consortium that Google, Microsoft, and Amazon are also involved with. And this is, you know, to do research and to kind of try to find the vaccine, try to kind of advance the research that's happening. And there's also a data pooling effort with companies like Salesforce to try to kind of collect patient data and try to find patterns within the cases that we're seeing and try to go into medical records. So there's all kinds of kind of tech efforts happening in a lot of different directions. Some of it we're seeing individually, like video conferencing, but then there's also robots in robot food delivery. There's software digging into medical records to try to find patterns, chatbots, even wearable temperature sensors is something I'm hearing about, is just monitors that you would wear that would be able to just give you the temperature that you have all the time, so you're not having to check it constantly.
You know, I think this speaks to our expectations about technology and how we look to technology to solve a lot of our problems. And then we hit something like COVID-19 where it can't, but everyone's sort of working in that same direction. In fact, as I understand it, some people who are involved with the supercomputer side of things are looking to individuals to perhaps give a little boost to those supercomputers. What's the story there?
Yeah, we've talked about this before, the Folding at Home project, which allows people with powerful kind of gaming PCs, even Macs and Linux computers, to use their graphics hardware to kind of help advance research. So they are definitely getting involved in kind of trying to understand the structure of the SARS and COVID-19 viruses. And so you can actually download the Folding at Home installer, set it up on your gaming PC, and then kind of help that research effort, kind of donate some of your computing power to that.
Omar Gayaga stays plugged into the tech world clearly, even when he's stuck at home, over at TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, thanks so much for dialing in, and stay safe and healthy.
Thanks, David. I really appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at TexasCollegeSavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Screening can lead to early detection and is recommended for all men and women age 45 and older. More at TexasOncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. You probably remember the pictures which went viral on social media earlier this month. Hundreds of passengers arriving at DFW amid warnings about the spread of coronavirus, maintaining your distance and all, only to end up packed in close quarters in a holding area at U.S. Customs as they awaited coronavirus screening. Well, now one of the people who spent hours in line there has tested positive for coronavirus. As KERA's Hadi Mawagde reports, she worries for the many other travelers with her that day.
Emma Swaim has been self-quarantined in her bedroom at her parents' home in Irvine, California. On a video chat, donning a robe and a ponytail, her spirits seem pretty high considering her symptoms.
Body aches, like I've never had a body ache before, like where it feels like someone took like a hot rod and like put it in your limbs.
Swaim described her time at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport as the most disgusting close contact with strangers she'd ever experienced.
I waited in a line for like over 3 hours with people who I now am very confident had coronavirus.
Swaim was one of several thousand travelers who packed into the airport that Saturday. She was returning home from a study abroad trip in Paris, and her description mirrors those shared on social media from DFW and other airports across the U.S.
So March 14th, when I was going through Dallas, was almost like watching the end of the world.
Swaim admits she knew things would be hectic at the airport, but Swaim says passengers were simply given forms to fill out.
It's sort of like when you land and they have you do like your customs paperwork, but asking if you have coronavirus.
Then a member of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would sign it.
It made it more backed up. They were understaffed. People were freaking out. And we spent more time in a contaminated area.
A spokesman for Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport tells KERA screening wait times have decreased dramatically and adds Customs and Border Protection were and are still in charge of processing, screening, and all procedures. In a statement to KERA, CBP said they've been working with international airports and local and federal partners to ensure a, quote, efficient and safe process flow for the traveling public. That statement added, Customs and Border Protection continues to facilitate the CDC's enhanced health screening of travelers entering the U.S. The CDC is responsible for enhanced health screenings of travelers in all locations. We reached out to the CDC to talk about these concerns. They did not respond to a request for comment.
Just to let you know that the Port of Health authorities are at the top of the jetty, so...
In the days since the hashtag DFW Airport was trending on social media, people returning to the country through Dallas are still posing questions about the screening process. Last week, Sarah Reyes and her partner Daniel Drinsky went through the same process as Emma Swaim. The Dallas-based videographers have been filming a documentary in Nepal, and they say they made plans to come back as soon as travel restrictions were announced. Drinsky says he thought...
They're definitely going to test us, at least take our temperatures, make sure we didn't have any symptoms. But when we got to Dallas, there was nothing like that. Just a questionnaire. But I could easily see where someone would lie and just say they didn't have symptoms to be able to get in.
Reyes says she was shocked that there wasn't more rigorous testing by the CDC.
Each of the flights that we were on, I mean, they were packed because flights were getting canceled. And the likelihood that somebody in there could have... COVID-19 was probably high.
The pair hasn't shown any signs of illness, but they say they're worried about their interactions at the airport. And Swaim, well, she's feeling lucky. She got help fast and is on the mend, but she's worried about what happens next.
My fear is like, oh, is this going to get really bad and then I'm going to be someone who can't breathe? Or like, is this over now? Like, I don't even know.
And neither do any of the thousands of people who were at DFW Airport on March 14th. Someone else might have caught the virus on that day, but officials haven't made any announcements. I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
Officials around the country are trying to warn younger folks that although the coronavirus appears to be most deadly among seniors, hospitals report that 40% or more of recent hospitalizations related to COVID-19 have been for people 40 and considerably younger. Nonetheless, those with a knowledge of Texas history may recall a deadly outbreak of another virus that hit Texas exceptionally hard, harder than any other state, some have said. And it seemed to have quite the reverse effect when it came to its generational impact. As commentator W.F. Strong remembers.
Dr. Heather Green Wooten, a medical historian and author of the award-winning book, The Polio Years in Texas, Battling a Terrifying Unknown, told me the story of how Texas responded to the polio epidemic that terrified the state every summer for years. Dr. Wooten told me that when San Angelo had a breakout of polio in 1949, the hardest hit town per capita that year in the U.S., it was horrifying in scope for the city of 50,000. 60 children in San Angelo came down with polio in one summer. Many died. Movie theaters and swimming pools and public gatherings were shut down. Travelers passing through would roll up their windows so as not to breathe the potentially contaminated air. Houses were kept spotless and were scrubbed top to bottom to kill all the germs. In fact, Dr. Wooten told me, when mothers lost a child to polio, they suffered added anguish because they felt they would be judged as bad mothers and poor housekeepers. There was a public service song by Red River Dave frequently played on the radio in those days. It stressed cleanliness. Here's a sample.
Take care that all the food you eat and kitchenware is clean. Wash your hands and toothies every time before you eat. If we learn this lesson, that all polio will beat.
The response to polio was largely a grassroots one, with the common man and children largely funding the research, the treatments, the hospitals and rehab centers. The March of Dimes, launched by FDR, was enormously successful in this regard. It mobilized school children and civic groups of all kinds to collect dimes, quarters, and dollars from anyone and everyone. The March of Dimes also introduced us to the concept of the poster child, one of the most persuasive fundraising strategies of all time. Collection receptacles in the form of little iron lungs were placed at cash registers everywhere. I like that one year the March of Dimes national campaign was launched from the community of Dime Box, Texas, about 70 miles east of Austin. How's that for creative marketing? Big money entered the fight as well. Texas' great oil men gave millions to build hospitals, treatment facilities, and fund research. Great institutions in Texas like the Scottish Rite Hospital for Crippled Children and the Gonzales Warm Springs Rehab Hospital for Crippled Children were among the best in the country, as was the Jefferson Davis Hospital in Houston. These hospitals were also among the first institutions to be fully integrated, accepting all races of children on equal terms, regardless of race, religion, or creed. Dr. Wooten notes that the children took to integration beautifully and became each other's best therapy. Doctors found that putting them together helped them function as a team against the disease, cheering each other on against a common enemy. Well, you know the rest of the story. Dr. Salk, funded by the March of Dimes, discovered the first vaccine for the virus in the early 1950s. And rather than getting a patent and becoming an instant billionaire, he made a gift of his vaccine to all humanity. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F. Strong is a Fulbright Scholar and Professor of Culture and Communication at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. You can check out more of his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We've all been hearing quite a bit about the prospect of Texas's healthcare facilities becoming overwhelmed by the sheer number of patients if the spread of the coronavirus can't be cut. In Texas, more than 400,000 healthcare professionals are employed by the state's most acute care hospitals. Carrie Kroll is with the organization that represents some 85% of those facilities, the Texas Hospital Association. She's the THA's Vice President of Advocacy, Quality, and Public Health. Carrie, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Let's talk about what that 85% means. How many hospitals roughly do you all represent?
So we represent about 475 of the state's 600 hospitals, so the vast majority of them.
Now, are you hearing from any facilities right now telling you we're going to have to close down because we are reaching that tipping point? Are we there yet?
So not from that perspective. We certainly have on the ground actively hospitals trying to figure out how best to deal with the patient surge, and that's going to look different depending on where they are in the state. We do have rural hospitals, however, that won't fare as well during this crisis because they have a limited number of beds to begin with, and one of the safety measures that's gone into effect across the state has been a cut down on elective surgeries. And so rural facilities that would get a book of business just from the regular day-to-day type of healthcare services aren't seeing that flow. So from a hospital may shut down perspective, I think that's the biggest concern immediately. The other hospitals are looking to figure out how they expand in a way that creates enough capacity to treat the sick people when they need to be treated.
We are hearing some alarming numbers when it comes to capacity, and maybe you can help me with this. As some people may realize, Texas has a population of almost 29 million people, give or take. What we're hearing is from some sources that up to 40% of the population could find itself infected. We don't know about Texas, of course. We're trying to level that off. But if it reaches that level, is there anything close to the number of hospital beds available to treat those who have symptoms?
So there's not a bed for every person, certainly. We have about 40,000 staffed beds in the state right now. So that's, you know, beds that come with someone in the healthcare system that can care for the patient. We know that as we speak, those numbers are increasing because hospitals are working to, in some instances, double beds in rooms. There are regulations that prevent that in a normal period of time. Mm-hmm. But with the situation unfolding with regulatory waivers that we've been able to request, they're in a position now to do that. And so 40,000 staffed beds currently, and that percentage is increasing as we see the daily reports come from our hospitals.
Another thing that we're hearing a lot about are supply shortages when it comes to equipment, testing certainly. But what about, for instance, ventilators and respirators? What's the situation as you understand it?
So again, not enough necessarily for the needs of the state, but there are efforts being made to make sure that that is expanding. So at the local level, we know that our hospitals have put in orders for additional capacity just from their typical vendors, but also the governor has set up this strike force where he has taken some professionals that are otherwise wouldn't be working in pandemic preparedness and put them on the ground trying to figure out how to improve manufacturing and increase distribution. So we are hopeful that those will continue to come online. Mm-hmm. And for the moment, hospitals, you know, are looking to make sure that they just have access to in the right kind of access and patterns to the ventilators that they do have.
Is it your sense that healthcare professionals in your hospitals in Texas are largely optimistic that this is going to turn out better than feared? Or what is the sense that the mood in hospitals right now?
I mean, I think that the good news is that hospitals spend a lot of time running preparedness drills. And we are doing our part at THA to just communicate throughout the community ways that we as everyday Texans can help support our healthcare workers by making smart choices, staying at home, checking if we need to visit a relative in the hospital, checking what that policy is so that we know in advance of showing up, making sure that we aren't wasting masks, that those are going to the people on the front line that need them. It's just at this point, the support inside of our hospitals is really emphasized by everything that people are doing in the community.
Carrie Kroll is the Vice President of Advocacy, Quality, and Public Health for the Texas Hospital Association, which represents some 85% of the state's acute care facilities. Carrie, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us. We certainly do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social media editor Wells Dunbar is back with us. I've been looking online, Wells, at some of the most recent reports from the Houston Chronicle, which is reporting now that there's a spike in reported cases of coronavirus there. And I don't know if you've seen some of the earlier reports from a little bit further east in Louisiana. A lot of concerns growing mm-hmm. out that direction about the Crescent City becoming another hotspot for COVID-19. So anyway, this is one of many reports online earlier.
Yeah, lots of reports online about New Orleans' failure to cancel some Mardi Gras facilities is being pointed to as a potential source of the outbreak there. Definitely another story we're continuing to monitor. Another bit of breaking news, somewhat surprising, our friends in El Paso apparently experiencing an earthquake there, feeling the results of an earthquake out in far west Texas, shaking parts of the city this morning. So another story we're continuing to watch and hearing from our friends and listeners and colleagues about. On a slightly brighter note, our talk about HEB and its response to the coronavirus crisis generating a lot of talk online, folks sharing their experiences in the grocery stores and applauding the people that keep them stocked. Robert Flood on our Facebook page says, it seems Americans do take for granted the efforts that are made every day and night to keep food stores stocked and running. My younger son works for Kroger, and those shelves are not magically stocked each night. It takes very dedicated right. people to help keep us all in our sheltered-in-place way of life. Thanks to all the food store workers, seen and unseen. And I also saw this tweet. I think you may have seen it too, David. I like it, from Hoth Mob. They tweet, I think HEB has a better emergency response team than our federal government. And as we heard earlier, HEB has a lot of experience sort of fulfilling that role in Texas.
I was just absolutely fascinated by the story of how they have these emergency response centers. And they were looking back way back in January, setting up, sort of gaming it out. What would the spread mean? But I was fascinated to read that they did not expect a run on toilet paper. I don't think anyone really expected a run on toilet paper. But HEB was not quite ready for that.
Continues to surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's important to take precautions when you go out to the grocery store. You see some folks in PPE, personal protective equipment, like gloves mm-hmm. and masks. But it's also important to keep others in mind as well. I'm getting to a tweet here from Lucia Briones. She tweeted us some pictures she took in an Austin shopping center of used gloves and masks lying on the ground, writing, discarded PPE are apparently turning into this year's plastic bag. She's not alone. She also shared those images on the Austin page of Reddit, and folks there noting similar instances. So it's sad it's come to this, but seriously, take care of each other's, take care of yourself.
Indeed.
And, you know, take anything you out, put that in the trash.
Put it in the trash, folks. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow. Till then, I'm David, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.